So good evening. My name is Paul Holden-Grabe. I'm the director of public programs here, known as Live from the New York Public Library. And it's a great pleasure to welcome you, Adam Gopnik, back to the library for the fourth time. So Adam is a real repeat offender. And it's a great pleasure. So
thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Adam and I have been doing public events together for quite some time, all the way back in my blissful years in Los Angeles, which I left for the dubious pleasures of New York, which we will talk about since you seem to think this is a good place to live and bring up children. am I under the right impression that you think
I believe that, though. But I know there was a certain intensity when you were in Los Angeles because you would bring together two sort of, you know, sad intellectuals, and everybody would be alight about it. They're debating museums down
at Blackmon. I know, it's exciting.
And Sharon Stone would come, and half the staff of CAA would come, and they'd be taking notes.
Well,
and
Sharon Stone, I do remember, came to meet Bernard-Henri Lévy.
Maybe
it was you. Maybe I kept thinking it might be me. but, you know, wishful thinking on my part. But right. Adam did an extraordinary event with Kirk Varnedoe, and we may actually be speaking a little bit about him. In Los Angeles, maybe 4 or 5 years ago or so. And, you know, these were two friends, and I don't particularly like chumminess on stage, so I'm going to try to become a little more conflictual as time goes on here. But they goaded each other extraordinarily well. And so Adam has been here many times, and it's a pleasure to welcome him back to the library. Adam, today something most amazing happened to me. I was reading your essay about 9/11, which we'll talk about in a minute. And the phone rings, and my assistant calls me, telling me that my sister from Paris called, wondering if I was safe. Mm-hmm. And I was in Brooklyn, and I was fairly safe. But she was extremely worried, because she had just heard, she was looking at television, some rugby match, I think, was going on, a football match. And she just had heard that a plane had
They are different sports, Paul.
They are. No, I true. But they both have a ball, right?
Yeah,
am I right?
Yes, you're right. You're right about that.
My children are younger, so I haven't yet gotten into the whole ball celebration. But my sister was very worried, and I called her up immediately to tell her I was fine. But there was some kind of a plane that flew into a building on 72nd Street. Mm-hmm. And there I was, reading your essay about 9/11, and reading, you know, how distinct and apart we can be from a tragedy, though we can see it because we're on a long island. And my sister reported to me that this was happening. She knew something that I, in my small world, not small at all because I was reading you, but small world, uncontaminated by the news that was happening at that moment.
But the other amazing thing, just one experience this afternoon, is the amazing efficiency of information in New York. You know, the people talk about efficient market theory on the stock market, how quickly information is processed through. And I heard about this tragedy at about 3 o'clock as I was leaving the office to come uptown. And by the time I got on the elevator to go up to my apartment, the guy who was in the elevator with me said, oh no, what it was nothing to do with terrorism. It was a pitcher for the Yankees, in fact, who crashed the plane, which turned out to be true. And 15 minutes later, when I came in and I was speaking to my son about it, he said, oh, Dad, the really interesting angle here is, I've just been in a chat room, is that Mike and the Mad Dog gave him a terrible time on their program yesterday. In fact, and everybody's furious with him for having put him in this incredibly timorous state.
Does this say something? I mean, in a way, this goes directly to the point, one of the points of your book, which is that New Yorkers are extraordinarily resilient, and that they will not leave the scene of, they will, maybe some people said very quickly that this was an act of terrorism. I'm sure somebody must have said that. But very quickly, they come together, they get over it, they move on.
Information spreads, people understand, people discount quickly, maybe too quickly, discount negative information, and it gets absorbed into the system, and it goes on. It's amazing. But not only does it go on, but it goes on in another way. So this whole Mike and the Mad Dog angle to the problem then rises up. Do you listen to Mike and the Mad Dog? typically. I listen to them every afternoon. They're one of the sub-themes, you know, so they're in the book,
actually.
I always
say that I have holes in my culture so it can breathe. this is one of those blatant holes.
They have a sports talk show, WFAN, every afternoon from 1 till 5, I guess. And I can't write without noise.
How long have you had that problem?
My entire life. In fact, I began writing coherently when I discovered that if I had a lot of rock music on, I could do it. So I always have Mike and the Mad Dog on in the afternoons when I'm writing, in fact. And they're in the book, too, because there's something about, you know, Mike Franceschi has he's one of the great old-fashioned kind of New York accents, and he states the obvious in a totally stentorian tone. You know, the team that is ahead at the end of any game is overwhelmingly likely to win that game, dog. And I totally identify with this, you know, because that's essentially the role I play. And but they apparently harassed this poor Yankee pitcher. So you immediately have a sub-story, you have a secondary story in New York, and you have this enormous overflow of information and this constant desire to turn that information into some kind of story, into some kind of narrative. And that's one of the things that the book is about.
So let me ask you, why, I mean, I arrived at the library about a couple of hours ago, totally drenched. Thankfully, I had a fresh pair of pants in my office to change into so I would look fairly respectable here on stage with you. And the subway was filled, and it was so crowded. And I was thinking, you know, I had spent 5 hours reading you this afternoon, and I was nearly convinced that this was a great city. I've been here for about 500 days. No, I really mean this. Of course, I'm just joking here. I think it's a fantastic city. It's actually, quite frankly, the best city in the world, no doubt. But why is this a great city? Why is this a great city to live in? I'll ask you a subsequent question to that. And why, in your view, since really the book is about your children, why is this a great city to bring up children?
I suppose any city, any can be and is, often is a great city to bring up children in. Bringing up children is in itself a wonderful thing. And so I think you would do it with equal satisfaction in Schenectady or Altoona or in Brussels or Paris. I think there's something enormously moving about bringing up children in New York, because it seems, at first at least, to be resistant to the activity. It doesn't seem to be a city that's designed for children. That's what the first thing people say about it when you say, you know, it's the subtitle of this book is A Home in New York,
right.
And it's meant to have a slightly, mildly ironic tinge, because we don't think of New York as a place primarily of homes. That's not our literary imagination of it.
You know, to make a home.
To make a home. It's that you make a deal in New York. You make a career in New York. But you don't make a home in New York. But in fact, of course, and self-evidently, all we make are homes in New York. We're, as human beings, all we can make in New York are our homes. And so what looks from the outside, what's presented in literature, what's shown in the movies, as a city of, you know, endless kind of Michael Douglas-like skullduggery and activity, actually becomes, in the lived, atomized, final chemical analysis of it, a city, this vast beehive of homes. And it's one, you know, we live in a big apartment building, and I write about this in the book, in fact, that every imaginable kind of human being seems to live in that apartment building. There's a Orthodox Jewish family down the hall. There's a single woman, an older single woman living there. There's a young man who works on Wall Street down here. There are famous people. There are forgotten people. There are unhappy people. There are angry people. Every imaginable social type lives, makes a home in that building. And then we see each other only in the elevator. We jostle each other, or we complain when one of us makes more noise. And that density is, I think, unique to New York and in New York.
That is my subsequent question is this one, because you used the word that I think is most telling to me, which is the word density. Could you tell me what makes a city great? Because I know that Rem Koolhaas, for instance, the great Dutch architect, believes that what makes cities great is congestion, which is usually what we want to flee. So I'm curious.
I think that's true. I think, with the caveat that it's congestion of people, not congestion of vehicles, not congestion of automobiles. I think that exactly what makes a city great is overcharge. an overload, in fact, the sense that you have that walking down the street, you will bump into and be bumped into by every imaginable kind of person. One of the stories in the book that is many people have read before, I think, is one called Bumping Into Mr. Ravioli. And it's about my then three-year-old daughter Olivia's imaginary friend. She had an imaginary friend named Charlie Ravioli. And what was interesting about Charlie Ravioli was he was always too busy to play with her. And she would get on her little play phone. You know, we had a little play cell phone. And she'd say, hello, can you call me? Okay, call me later. And then she put it down. She said, I always get his machine. In fact, that was true. And she had made up this imaginary character who was sort of a prince of our preoccupied disorder. Because you had an imaginary friend who she had genuinely imagined for herself who would never be available for her, who was always pressed. And when things went well, exactly what she would say is, I bumped into Charlie Ravioli today. She would say, I bumped into Charlie Ravioli today. We grabbed a cappuccino, but then he had to run. And it's what she had heard. It's what she had heard her mother say, what she had heard me say, what everybody who she knew, that's all, you know, there's this, you know, little three-year-old girl, and she's walking through a world where all she hears all day is her mother saying, you know, I bumped into Meg, but then she had to run, so then I grabbed a cab, and I got up just in time, but I was a little bit late, but I sent you an email. Did you get it? And it's that, so, you know, country children make their imaginary friends out of light and sand and the breeze and the trees, and our children make their imaginary friends up out of busyness.
And we all laugh at the story you're telling here, but in a way there's also, I imagine, a certain pathos or a certain sadness in the fact that we are so occupied that we're perpetually preoccupied. We're so busy. I mean, busyness, which is a word you explore very beautifully in that essay, was not always a negative term.
No, as I explained, in fact, if you look at, you know, when Samuel Pepys is writing his diary, and whenever he uses the word busy, he uses it as a synonym for happy. Usually he uses it as a synonym for sex. I was very busy this evening with my wife.
And I usually use it that way myself.
I unfortunately never can use it that way, okay, as it turns out. But that's what busyness is. And it's only, I think, in the late 19th century, as I explained in the essay, that people, that when you had this sudden crush of trains and cars, along with the telegraph and all of its hideous stepchildren, the phone call, the fax, the email message, that for the first time in history, you had this double dose of physical bumping into and virtual bumping into. And as I say in the essay, one of the things that's true, I think, about the telegraph and all its children is that it's the only kind of communication that's ever been invented that's perpetually suspended. So, you know, when the Apostle Paul is writing an epistle, he doesn't say at the end of the epistle, give me a call and let's discuss. He just finishes the letter.
But and you open the letter when you so desire.
And you open the letter when you desire, whereas every email ends, give me a call and let's discuss. And every fax says, I'll get in touch with you by email. And so that perpetually staved off communication is part of what we live with. But you know, though the story, I wanted to have a little pathos because it has some, for me, in fact, is overwhelmingly happy. Because, and it happened, and I wrote that story in 2002. Right. And it occupied just the year after 9/11. That is, Olivia came up with Charlie Ravioli in that year, invented Charlie Ravioli. And it became a talisman for my wife and for me. We would always say, well, how did you spend the day? And we'd say, oh, and you couldn't begin to describe all of the misconnections, frustrations, exasperations, failures, and madnesses of a day in New York. So we'd just say, yes, bumping into Charlie Ravioli. And it was meant to include, to comprise, all of those things. And we had an enormous tenderness for it, because it was exactly what we loved about New York, was bumping into Charlie Ravioli. And in that year, it came haloed, I think, with a certain kind of warmth. That's New York. That's what would be devastating to lose. That's the thing we love. And I think one of the things that's been true about New York in the past 5 years is that all of that kind of little affect and busyness and tone of the city, which it's easy to find so exasperating that it drives you away, drives you to the suburbs where my wife is always trying to drive me, or drives you back to Los Angeles, in fact, is incredibly wonderful in and of itself, and also because this is the last place that's like that. You know, in the last 5 years, as I write in the book, we used to think of Rome as sort of the of New York as the new Rome, kind of the Rome of the new millennium, this kind of great, vast, sewer of ambitions and greeds. But in the last...
It's not only that.
But it's not only that. It's also, as I say in the book, it's also become, the last 5 years, it's become a kind of, in our imaginations at least, a kind of new Venice of fragility, of beauty and fragility. Because you're aware, as you are when you're in Venice, this city, Venice, could only exist once. The idea that, we'll make the city, but it's all water. It's all right. We'll all go in boats. And we'll make it work. And you have the same feeling about New York. You know, it's on this tiny little island, Manhattan. You're on this tiny little island. We don't have enough room here. We can't work this. We'll build the buildings very, very high. It'll be all right. We'll work it. We'll make it work. And we'll build the buildings very high, but we don't have any room anymore. Well, we'll build them even higher, and then we'll make them very skinny and very high. And then how will we travel? Well, we'll build a big hole in the ground, and everyone will go in trains in the big hole. That kind of absurdity and impossibility of New York, which seemed to us until recently as self-evident as the impossibility of Venice must have seemed to Venetians through the 16th century. And then suddenly, one day in the 18th century, everyone said, my God, what a beautiful, strange city. There'll never be another one like it. And I think that that sense, what a beautiful, strange city, there'll never be another one like it, is a kind of piercing realization that's only come to us in the last 5 years.
But I'm assuming that in using the word vulnerable, you're also alluding to 9/11 in some form. And it reminded me a little bit of Paul Valéry's line right after the Second World War in 1919. He said that he realized that now civilizations are also mortal.
Yes, exactly.
And
yes.
That they also also die, as it were. And that vulnerability is something that maybe we want to take care of.
We want
to take care. We become the doctor of the city in some way.
Yes, I think that's right.
2002 is when you wrote Ravioli. If you had to update that essay, how would you do so?
Well, I do update it a little bit in the book. I wouldn't update the core of it, but I would bring the characters up to date because after that essay was published, Olivia explained to us, and I had the most wonderful years writing these pieces because, like everyone in New York, our apartment is sort of one size too small for us. It was. And I didn't have a real study, so I just had a kind of alto screen that I would hide behind with my computer, and it was right outside Olivia's bedroom and right near the kitchen. So all day long, I was sort of the forgotten man. Nobody remembered that I was actually there. I was like Bartleby the Scrivener back behind my little my little thing. And I would hear Olivia very freely talking to her mother at lunchtime every day. And every day, because she felt very free just talking to her mother, she could tell her any story, and your mother will always believe any story you tell them. So she explained that Ravioli had gotten married to a wonderful woman named Queda. And we debated for a while whether that was K-W-E-E-D-A, an African princess, or Q-U-E-E-D-A, you know, sort of Bulgarian royalty. We decided it was K-W. He got married to Queda. They went on a honeymoon to a beautiful place called Cornfields, which I always think was like one of those wasp resorts you read about in Gourmet magazine, you know, like come to beautiful Cornfields. And then one day, Olivia announced, Queda has died. I'm sad to say that Queda has died. She's died of a terrible disease called bitterosity. She's died of a terrible disease called bitterosity. And I thought, everybody I know is dying from bitterosity. In fact, I don't know a single New Yorker who doesn't have one degree or another of bitterosity infecting their system. You know, it's what happens to all of us. It's happening to you, Paul.
Believe me, I've become so fierce in this city. And nearly rude at times. I feel like from time to time I drink Drano in the morning.
Exactly. And bitterosity, and if you try and inoculate yourself against bitterosity and you do all the things, you go running in the park and you see your friends and you drink wine in order. It's sort of like bitterosity is to us as, you know, consumption was to the 19th century. We don't have a cure for it, but we do all these superstitious things that we think will keep it off, in fact. So it was another wonderful metaphor for the painful side of New York life. And really, and it's quite seriously, bitterosity is the thing that threatens us, threatens our mental health here, and is a very hard thing. To be pure in heart in New York is almost impossible. Which may be why, actually, one of the reasons why raising children here is such a joy, because children, though not innocent of malice, are pure in heart in that way. They're not bitter. It's very rare you meet a bitter six-year-old. You meet angry six-year-olds, you meet hostile six-year-olds, you meet enraged six-year-olds.
But they're not sarcastic.
They can be sarcastic and sort of big, but they're not bitter. You know, they don't say, "I made the wrong decision. It's my fault. It'll never be better." They don't say. They say, "I hate you. I hate you," and they slam the door.
Or as you say in one of your essays, I hate you and I don't even like you.
Yeah, oh, yes, my Olivia said to me once, we were arguing because she couldn't go to bowl at Bowlmore, the bowling place downtown. And she stood on the sidewalk and outside and she said, I don't even like you. She said, I used to love you and now I don't even like you. And I hear her saying that every time
I
go by.
Updating, I was thinking of, I realized you updated the essay in that form, is just that our lives in the last 5 years through various technologies possibly have become even busier. I think, as I like to call it, the forbidden fruit I walk around with everywhere, the BlackBerry, is another object of torture. It just, you become completely addicted.
And the worst of the BlackBerry is, too,
you
is
have
that...
One?
No, I don't have a BlackBerry. I wouldn't be trusted with a BlackBerry. I would lose it somewhere within the first 6 hours, in fact, and then someone else would have it and would be sending in text to the New Yorker all the time. We'd be publishing it. But what's terrible, too, is because I've gotten emails from you on BlackBerry, is it says at the bottom, sent via BlackBerry, which gives you this terrible feeling of your poor friend walking down the street, pumping his thumbs against this.
I'm one of those. Against
the thing. But, you know, the truth is the other part of it, too, which no one could have anticipated is that the more of these labor-saving devices you have, the harder it is to get work done. So finally, your whole struggle in a New York life is to be less busy in order to actually be productive. In other words, you know, we're sort of like the people in the Matrix, right? We have six orifices open with cables plugged into them all day long, and you struggle to unplug yourself. That's half.
Well, also, what always strikes me is when you ask people how they are, they say, I'm busy, which is really not an answer to the question.
Yeah. Actually, you know, it's interesting. In New York, it sort of is a socially acceptable answer. If you say to somebody, I haven't seen you in a couple of months. What have you been doing? You say, oh, I've been busy. And people say, oh, yeah, well. But if you go to Paris or any place in Europe, in fact, and you try to pull that stunt, you lose all your friends, right? Because friendship makes certain demands, right? And it was one of the things that was very hard to learn when we lived in Paris in those years.
Let's talk about that. What is wonderful, I think, about having a conversation with Adam is that truly it's digressive as an essay form is. And digression, in a way, is a sunshine of narrative, as I've often said.
I saw the later questions you want to ask me, Paul, so I'm keeping moving on.
Oh, you did. Okay.
in another direction.
What was the question? I lost the thread, but it will come back to
me. If I continue to row this canoe in a long enough circle, I can evade all the hard questions.
So the question I was about to ask you is really not hard at all, and a pleasure to ask you. We heard some French music before you came on stage, and I would love you to compare and contrast those 5 years you spent in Paris with the 5 years you've been back, and talk a little bit about Adam Gopnik's life in Paris and the texture of your daily life there, which is a texture probably quite different from what you experience here. I imagine.
Well, yes and no.
Maybe you're the same driven
it's the same
kind of person.
The truth is for any writers, in any writer's life, your life from day to day is always exactly the same. You sit in front of a screen and you stare at it for hour after hour after hour, in your shorts or your pajamas or your bathrobe, and you have these tiny little slices of experience which you then try to transform into stories. So whenever people say, oh God, you must have had such a wonderful time living in Paris, the life you had, or even say in a more complimentary way, oh, when the way you described your life in Paris made me wish to live it, there's always a little bitter, ironic part of me that thinks, no, mostly what I did in Paris was I sat at a desk and I stared at a screen hour after hour after hour, creating those symbols of the stuff that sounded so pleasant. Now the stuff actually took place, but the necessity of a writer's life is that there's, you know, there's this thin skin of balloon and this vast cloud of hot air that you pump into it, in fact, in order to bring the literature aloft. So in that sense, it wasn't that different. In another sense, of course, it was very different. My wife, Martha, said when we were struggling to decide whether to stay in Paris or move back to New York, that in Paris we had a beautiful existence but not a full life, and in New York we have an unbeautiful existence and a very full life. And I think that was true. That's a reflection as much of us, I guess, as it is of Paris. But one of the things that is true of Paris, I think, is that it is not a city. One of the things that makes New York wonderful is that it's a city of weak ties. You know 1,000 people who you bump into, and you know relatively few of them very well, but you know many of them a little bit, and you're constantly engaged in them in small ways. At the end of the book, I have a whole section about how with my usual ineptitude, I couldn't get Wi-Fi hooked up in our apartment, so I was always stealing my neighbor's Wi-Fi. I no longer do that. I'm an honest guy, and I let other people steal mine. But I would pull, does anyone else do this? But I would pull down the menu on my Apple thing at 3:30 in the morning, searching for somebody, one of the neighbors, you know, Ellen, Mark, someone who had a thing. And we were engaged in this weird copulative act of sharing the ether, but we had no other connection. So that's, you know, the kind of weak tie that you have in New York. Paris is a city, and I think this is generally true of European cities, is a city of strong ties. That is to say, you have a clan, a cohort that you've known since you were 17. You have a family, perhaps. But you have deep friendships, which you cannot abandon. You know, if you drop a friend in France, not deliberately, but if you simply don't see or speak to a friend in Paris for 2 months, it's a really mortal insult. It shows a lack of regard and consideration for that friend. You've turned them from a strong tie into a weak tie. In New York, if you turn a strong tie into a weak tie, being a weak tie is in a certain sense a sanctioned state, so it's not so bad. You say, where have you been? I haven't seen you in so long. You say, oh, I've been busy. Oh, me too. And you can go back in. So that's one of the charms of New York, I think, and one of the things that makes it so different.
And one of the ways in which you're addressed in France, and perhaps particularly in Paris, is people don't ask you as a first question what you do.
Yes, they never ask you what you do. They never ask you how much you make. Not that people really do that here, but they ask you how much you've spent for something very often.
And figure out the rest.
Yes, and figure out the rest. Right. Then they divide by 12 and multiply by 2, and you have the relevant number. So that's one of the things that's very different. People don't ask you what you do, and you're assumed to have a different role. And you know something else that's extraordinary that actually fits into this is that in all the years I lived in Paris, and even now when I go back to Paris usually once a year, if you read a book by someone you find interesting, a writer, philosopher, journalist, and you finagle their telephone number or their email, and you call them up or write them and said, I read your book, I greatly admired it, I'd love to talk to you, could we meet for coffee? Almost without exception, whether it's Jean Baudrillard or Michel Houellebecq or whoever it is, they say, with a sigh, visible or implied, oh yes, all right, let's meet at 4:30 at whatever the cafe on the corner is. And there's the sense that you have a sort of obligation to do that. You have to do it. Well, you can imagine, you know, if you, emailed Norman Mailer and said, could you meet me? I've always been interested in your work. I think it's very improbable, in fact, that I will do it. You can email me. I'll go do anything to avoid having to be in front of that screen for 8 hours. But I think that that's there's a role. You can, in France, you can play, you're expected to play a social role that's independent of your actual working life. In other words, your life doesn't break down simply into your working hours, as it does here, and your domestic hours. You have, there's a space there that's for consulting, orating, adultery, being sententious, and drinking coffee. That's a few hours you fit into the day between work and responsibility. We have nothing but work and responsibility.
Right, and your list probably not necessarily in that order. just to stay for one more moment in Paris, what do you miss from those years? And since you claim to think that New York doesn't inspire in you, especially when you arrive in New York from LaGuardia, any sense of nostalgia, but Paris and perhaps Europe does. Reminds me of, you know, Kundera's line that the European is someone who longs for Europe. And I'm just wondering, what do you miss?
About Paris?
Yeah, whether it's an imagined missing or a real missing.
It's hard to articulate, Paul, but what I genuinely miss, you know, I don't miss, you know, the kind, either the absurd stuff or the insanely exasperating stuff. I don't know how to put it. I used to go on about 3:30 in the afternoon most days when I was done writing. It actually speaks to what I was talking about a moment ago. My son was quite small still, and I would push him in his poussette, his stroller, to the Luxembourg Gardens, and he would play in the playground, and I would sit with a little coffee. You could get a coffee and a little piece of chocolate, which they always give you with an espresso in Paris. And I would sit there with Le Monde, which had just come out in the afternoon, and reading Le Monde, watching him with half an eye play in the park, drinking the coffee, having the little piece of sugar, which usually had the picture of a poet on it, or, you know, it being French sugar. I would do that, and there was an enormous sense, maybe completely unearned and maybe totally illusory, but very profound, that you were participating in an old culture, that you were doing something that was, in the most beautiful sense, well-worn and smooth, that long walk to the gardens, the walk back, was something that you was shared, that you were kind of etching a deep groove in history. I mean, yours part of the groove was tiny, but that there was a deep groove that ran from the Luxembourg Gardens back to the left, to your apartment on the left bank, that Samuel Beckett and E.M. Cioran and Verlaine had all trod before. And that sense of deep continuity, I don't mean a continuity of, you know, I just had a, you know, brilliant artistic idea, because people don't have brilliant artistic ideas anymore in Paris. But that sense in which a certain kind of civilized motionlessness ran into a certain kind of civilized continuity. It's almost mystical, and I'm not describing it well, but that was the thing I miss most in Paris, and that you can't recreate in New York.
I detected a slight criticism of French culture in what you just said.
No.
Which I tend to agree with, namely that...
Maybe a better way of putting it, Paul, is that French civilization remains for me one of the miracles of humankind. French culture, both French official culture, meaning culture of administration and of bureaucracy and so on, remains one of the world's great difficulties, in fact. And French artistic culture at this time, not uniformly, not in the movies, for instance. I think French film is in a wonderful moment of renaissance, wonderful kind of neorealist thing, not yet sufficiently well known here, I think. But I think this French New Wave is as good as the old French New Wave, maybe not quite that good, but very good.
Let's go to something that might also be French-inspired, though I'm sure there are deep-rooted connections and influences in the American essay form. I'm interested in the form in which you write. I'm interested in the form you choose to write in, which is the essay form. And I'd love you to talk a little bit about this. And I must say that I was particularly taken, we might do this little exercise together, reading your book parallel to E.B. White's wonderful essay about New York.
Well, we wanted to call tonight, Where is New York, in homage to White, who said, here is New York, and we're all stuck asking, where is New York? What is New York? What is the condition of New York at the beginning of the new millennium? I love the essay. I never know quite what adjective to attach to it. You know, people say the personal essay, but that always reminds you of sort of things in the back of McCall's, you know, and so on. I say comic sentimental essay, which is probably too Rococo form for it. But whatever it is, I love...
Unpack that notion, though.
Comic sentimental?
Yeah, because
well, the comic essay
I've
is meant to be funny, and that's the thing I most value in writing. It would be hard for me to imagine really enjoying reading anything that wasn't, among other things, funny.
Humorous
is too flat a word. It's, you know, humorous implies sort of like, you know, the guy who writes a column in the local paper. Funny, you know, really genuinely coming out of some appreciation of the, not just the absurdity of life, but there's such a close relationship between common sense and comedy that, you know, comedy is just common sense set dancing. And that's what that's the kind of comedy I love. But the great thing about the essay, and sentimental, because pugnacious way, because sentimental is a word we use only as a pejorative now, but of course in its origins, it's a positive word. It's a word meaning paying great attention to feeling. You know, C.S. Peirce, the great American philosopher, once defended the idea of sentimentality. He said, what do we truly mean by sentiment? He said, we only mean, and I'm going to forget the quote having raised it, we only mean paying great attention to the motions of a sensitive heart. And I think that that's right, and that's the other element I love in writing, where you are willing to be vulnerable enough on the page to pay great attention to the sensitivities of a tender heart. Not of your own, but of the world, the situation, the people you're describing.
In some way, is like no other form.
The essay form is, I think, unique amongst all literary forms because it's the one place, in prose at least, I suppose you can do this in lyric poetry too, but no, not really, where ideas and feelings, where thoughts and emotions have completely equal place, in fact. That is that you generally begin an essay or start an essay with a funny story, a funny and you hope a touching story. Your daughter has an imaginary friend. Your daughter's goldfish has died. Something small of that kind. You're trying to have a baby and there are French doctors. On and on in this book, you know, I had to go do security patrol for the kids' school, and so on. And then from that little bit of feeling or that little bit of funniness, you can construct an argument. You can say, and that made me think of something else. And then that thing that it made me think of can become a structure in and of itself, as in Charlie Ravioli saying, well, what is the nature of business? And then you can go deep into Pepys and Virginia Woolf and Henry James and how did bourgeois
also,
people...
Or lightly.
Right,
I
exactly.
Mean, deeply and lightly.
Lightly, preferably right, lightly, yeah, I hope yeah. lightly. And you can do that, and then you can turn back towards the original feeling or narrative that you began with. So the essay is, I think, a very difficult form to do well. People often have the, I think, mistaken idea that it's the most sort of self-bearing of forms. And I don't think it is at all. I think, in fact, it's the most self-concealing of forms. Because it's the one form where, you know, if you're writing a short story, right? If John Updike is writing a short story and the woman is undressing in front of a mirror, he can just undress the woman in front of the mirror and then bring on her husband.
Whenever you describe something, you go like
oh,
this.
Oh, do I really? That is a built-in tick of
I
the 40 years of
Updike
doing
Updike undressing a woman. Right, it's right, something exactly. like this.
That yeah. is the way writers yeah. undress women. Yeah, we undress women this way, in fact, or and never this way, because we're not, that's
it's
where
a
we
technique, didn't. I'm sure.
And women writers undress men in the same way, only even stronger. They even dig deeper into the keyboard. So you can do, so you know, and you know, but in a story, you can, if you intrude an argument, right, into it, if Alice Munro is writing about, you know, the bleak sadnesses of the Lower Ontario heart, and then she said, and it made me think of the way the Canadian Confederation actually began with a misunderstanding. You'd say, this doesn't belong in this story, Alice. Please don't put this argument into the middle of this beautiful story. And similarly, if you're constructing an argument about the nature of Canadian Confederation, and you say, and it made me remember the sad and wistful moment when my mother growing up outside Toronto, you say, well, this doesn't really belong in this. But in the essay, the sad and wistful moment and the argument about Canadian Confederation do belong together. That's the nature of the form. And as a consequence, it's the one where you have to be the most rigorous, it seems to me, about it's not a memoir. An essay is not a memoir. An essay is not a confession. That's
quite,
not
quite literally, it's something, it's a form in which you try out.
Yes.
But you also essay. It has double meaning.
Yes.
Both trying out and weighing.
Yes.
And, you know, the French got a little bit into trouble because they mixed the essay with the novel so often. I mean, Sartre in particular, if you think...
Well, yes, but in Sartre's novel, it's sort of obvious that that's an essayist at work who's put on, you know, who's got a ventriloquist dummy on his knee called the novelist, right?
Right.
And then things are going on, and he clears his throat and says, and that makes me think of something. When Heidegger says that, in fact, the second form of being is that he's wrong, and then you just see the real Sartre coming out, right, because he's fed up with all these other people he has to play with, and he's speaking. But in an essay, so that's what makes, I think, Sartre's novels unsatisfactory very often. But in an essay, it's the perfect form for the Sartres of the world, in fact. And I think that that's one of the things that makes it very difficult, and also makes it, for me at least, my favorite form to read, much less to write.
I'd like to read something, if you don't mind. Let me find this passage, which is in a chapter called The City and the Pillars, which refers directly to 9/11.
I wrote it 2 days after, I guess on the Thursday of that week.
Didn't know that. I said earlier that I had been rereading, or maybe I didn't say earlier, I think maybe I said told you, I did say it, that I had been rereading Here's New York by E.B. White, and was very struck in E.B. White. Maybe I'll be, which way should I begin? I'll begin with you. And I'd been very struck in E.B. White's short book on New York that he foresees in some very uncanny way the towers. I mean, though I'm not sure he's talking about that or it's bombs falling on
the
city.
He's writing, I think, in
49.
He's conscious of the fact that New York has suddenly
vulnerable.
Become a target, has become vulnerable. And he writes about the arrival of the men in the planes. He means men in planes carrying atomic weapons.
Right.
Not men in planes crashing them into buildings. But that sense of foreboding he announces in 1949 in a way that seemed tragically prescient.
2 weeks after 9/11. Here is your last paragraph. Maybe I should have you read it. From here, New York, to the end there, so we hear you reading it.
I wrote, New York, E.B. White wrote in 1949, holds a steady, irresistible charm for perverted dreamers of destruction because it, the city, seems so impossible. He wrote, the intimation of mortality is part of New York now, in the sound of jets overhead. We have heard the jets now, and we will probably never be able to regard the city with quite the same exasperated, ironic affection we had for it before. Yet on the evening of that day, one couldn't walk through Central Park or down 7th Avenue or across an empty but hardly sinister Times Square, past the light on the trees or the kids on their scooters or the people sitting worried in the outdoor restaurants with menus, frowning, as New Yorkers always have, as though they had never seen a menu before, without feeling a surprising rush of devotion to the actual New York, Our Lady of the Subways, New York as it is. It is this, I've written earlier on, that New York exists both as a symbolic city, you know, as a city of the Empire State Building and the Statue of Liberty and all of these of the symbolic associations we have with it, and as a real city, a place where we make a home. New York as it is the symbolic city that draws us here, but the real city that keeps us here. It seems hard but important to believe that city will go on, because we now know what it would be like to lose it, and it feels like losing life itself.
And listen to E.B. White here, and then I'd like to talk about these two texts side by side. The subtlest change in New York is something people don't speak much about, but that is in everyone's mind. The city, for the first time in its long history, is destructible. A single flight of planes no bigger than a wedge of geese can quickly end this island fantasy, burn the towers, crumble the bridges, turn the underground passages into lethal chambers, cremate the millions. The intimation of mortality is part of New York now. In the sound of jets overhead, in the black headlines of the latest edition. And the last two paragraphs of E.B. White's text reads as follows. I think that, in a way, reading them side by side with what you just read, is quite powerful. This race between the destroying planes and the struggling parliament of man, it sticks in all our heads. A city at last perfectly illustrates both the universal dilemma and the general solution. This riddle in steel and stone is at once a perfect target and the perfect demonstration of nonviolence, of racial brotherhood, this lofty target scraping the skies and meeting the destroying planes halfway home of all people and all nations, capital of everything, housing the deliberations by which the planes are to be stayed and the errand forestalled. A block or two west of the new city of man is Turtle Bay. There's an old willow tree that presides over an interior garden. It is a battered tree, long suffering and much climbed, held together by strands of wire, but beloved of those who know it. In a way, it symbolizes a city. Life under difficulties, growth against odds, sap rise in the midst of concrete, and the steady reaching for the sun. Whenever I look at it nowadays and feel the cold shadow of the plains, I think, this must be saved, this particular thing, this very tree, and then this most amazing last sentence. If it were to go, all would go. This city, this mischievous and marvelous monument, which not to look upon would be like death. Was E.B. White on your mind very much?
I feel a bit like James Fry on Oprah right now.
No, you know,
exposed.
I don't feel like
yeah,
Oprah.
Of course.
Let me just say, but
nor I like James Fry. Yes, of course. White is a writer I profoundly love. In fact, I think I've never discussed White, in part because I do love him so much. I've written and talked about Thurber a great deal and Liebling, other writers from the magazine's history that I love and Updike, who have influenced me. White is a writer I couldn't possibly be more unlike in all the ways, but a writer who I love. And I do think, in a certain way, there's a kind of mixture of the particular and the rhetorical that White has on hand is in that sentence, is in that passage, which I keenly admire. And yes, absolutely, when I was writing that piece, that essay on 9/11, I was acutely aware of whites here as New York, because it seemed to define so much of what one loved about New York, and also because he had made this prophecy about New York as a vulnerable place, which had not come true, which had seemed totally, that imagination of catastrophe seemed to have evaporated with the passing of the 1940s. It's very touching. He talks about the Parliament of Man. He believed in the UN. He believed in world government, which seems to us very terribly dated now. And he, well, it does.
As we look,
he believed it and used the pages of the magazine to, you know, to, in the best sense, propagandize for it and so on. I think it was very much something that was on my mind as I was writing. And, you know, it's funny because it's one of the things essays do, of course, is that they're what do they call that in the academy, intertextual in that way. You know, you're
well, we could have spoken earlier on right, about writing, of influence.
Yes,
now,
we write about writing, you know, the essayist is in that sense, I suppose, probably for its own bedraggled.
But in this way, I didn't feel at all I know you were teasing me, but I actually was trying to make a deeper point about the whole notion of essay, which is in a way that...
And as a consequence, let me add something here that's more belligerent, too. As a consequence, the essay seems to many people the wrong form for tragedy, in fact. And people feel, I know, that you can't write essays in the face of tragedy. The essay is a diminutive form. And that to position it in the face of tragedy with all of its little curlicues of complexity and all of its intertextuality and all of its combination of argument and emotion is wrong. That when you're face to face with some terrible horror, you can't write about it in that form. Right. And I understand that. It seems to me that writers write. There's always something to be said. You know, it's one of the great arguments, one of the great undecidable issues of the 20th century. What do you do in the face of horror?
The famous comment by Adorno that after Auschwitz, lyrical poetry is no longer possible.
But that didn't turn out to be true. And, you know, one of my great heroines, I suppose I have to say, and the person who supplies one of the two epigraphs for this book, is Szymborska, the great Polish poet. And Szymborska was born...
Fantastic poem.
Amazing poem. Yeah. And Szymborska was born... And the worst possible time for a human being to be born, probably. And the poem is that superintends this book is called A Tale Begun by Wisława Szymborska, the great Polish poet who won the Nobel Prize just a few years ago, one of the few occasions in which the Nobel Prize went to the right writer. And the poem begins, "The world is never ready for the birth of a child. Our ships are not yet back from Winland. We still have to get over the St. Gotthard Pass. We've got to outwit the watchmen on the desert of Thor, fight our way through the sewers to Warsaw's center, gain access to King Harold the Butterpat, and wait until the downfall of Minister Fouché. Only in Acapulco can we begin anew." Meaning that in any historical moment, there's always some reason why having a child is the worst imaginable thing you can do. And of course, she goes on in the poem, as you can imagine, to say, like it or not, here it comes, here he comes, here she comes, that there's never a good moment to have a child. And I use it in the book to suggest that that's always true, that there never is a good moment to have a child, but we're never going to get to Acapulco. We're just never going to get there. So if we're going to begin anew, we're going to have to begin anew here. And now, so Szymborska, born in Poland at the worst possible time for a human being to be born, that is at the end of the First World War, with all of the horrors of the Second World War and of the Russian occupation of Poland to face, does write lyric poetry of an incredibly high order. And what she writes about is exactly that contradiction, exactly about the necessity of pressing on, even though we're never going to get... You don't write lyric poetry in Acapulco. You write it when you're trying to get, as she says, to the sewers in Warsaw. So I think that that's...
The belligerent nature here is that you're answering some of your critics.
Yes, which I often do belligerently, but usually it's about 3:30 in the morning, and only my wife listens, and she's heard it enough times, and she turns over. That's a thriving but insufficiently celebrated literary genre, but probably even more important than the essay, is the...
What is that book, The Art of Making Enemies?
Right. Well, not so much that. It's the 3:30 in the morning mutter to your spouse, the writer's muttering to the spouse. Then the spouse has heard it all before, and then turns over. Some people publish these mutterings, in fact. And it's usually a bad idea. They usually tend to think that was a bad idea to publish the long muttering to the spouse. So usually you turn over and you read, I read Bill James, the baseball analyst, and you get back to sleep. And you begin anew the next morning, in fact. But I do think, Paul, in all seriousness, in that great argument, which I think Szymborska answers as best as anyone could by having lived through all that and gone on writing, not just as she did, but writing the kinds of things she did, which are about the details of daily life, about children pulling tablecloths from tables, about going to see the doctor and getting undressed in front of the doctor and so on, answered it the best she could. But I do think there's something always to be said for silence in the face of tragedy. And there's something to be said for sensibility. There's something to be said for trying to organize fluently through all the resources you have as a writer, other writing, metaphor. We do it with tragedy all the time. You know, the last essay in this book is called Last of the Metrozoites, and it's about the last year in the life of a friend of both of ours, Kirk Varnadoe, the great art historian. And in that year, Kirk was dying of cancer. He's my closest friend. And also giving his brilliant series of lectures at the National Gallery, and also coaching this flag football team of 8-year-olds, including my own son. And that was, you know, a very hard blow, as hard a blow as I've ever had to face, was watching this extraordinary man die. And you could be silent in the face of it, or you could try to write about it. And when the minute you try to write about it, it means you organize it. You don't organize it in some, you know, abstract apocalyptic way, if I can mispronounce a new adjective, as an aesthetic artifact, but you try to organize it using everything that you have on hand.
And Kirk was not sentimental about his own illness.
Not only not sentimental about it, he was incredibly plain-spoken about it. He would tell you, I'll give these lectures, the Mellon lectures, and then I'll die. And he wasn't saying it with bravura, he wasn't saying it with melodrama, he was just saying it because he knew that that was the case. And he chose, in the face of certain death, certain mortality, he knew he was not, you know, he bitter irony, he was re-diagnosed with cancer just before 9/11 and died 18 months later. And in the face of it, he chose neither to complain about it, nor to honor it by describing it and becoming hysterical about it, and he chose...
It's incurable but treatable.
Right, is what he said, which meant it was incurable, in fact. And he... But by reiterating his allegiance to art in every sense, to abstract art, which is what he talked about, to the art of teaching, to the art of making football plays for 8-year-olds. And it was his belief that meaning is something we create. It's something we have to create every day. And that by the act of making meanings, whether you're making a pass pattern for an 8-year-old's football team, or you're explaining the inner workings of a Twombly, or you're going down, I remember right after 9/11, we went down all together with the kids and Kirk and his wife Ellen, and we went to see the Richard Serres, his wonderful Torque d'Ellipses, and sort of kicked them and kicked around in them. And that was for him, in the presence of those abstract aesthetic artifacts, that was an affirmation of what we believed in, of both life itself and also the freedom of the individual to make perverse and obscure things, and that was part of the inheritance of our culture. And one of the things that was very moving was about, of all the people I knew after 9/11, certainly not including the badly rattled me, he was the only person who wasn't rattled by it.
He and...
And our friend who I call Sally, who was actually Patty Marks, the comedy writer, right. Because comedy writers and ill people have in common the knowledge that it's never going to work out, but you're going to manage all right. He said, you know, we can either choose to be... the one thing we can't afford to do is let our fears dominate our lives in a way that reduces the possibilities of living. And I think that's true.
And I'm happy to say, though, this is purely in the first stages, that we might have the pleasure of having Adam back to offer an homage to Kirk Varnadoe, whose lectures, Mellon lectures, are coming out as we speak in about 2-3 weeks from now. And when speaking with Adam about how we might do it, he said, you know, we really shouldn't do something that is commemorative in the way that one might think of doing it, sentimentalizing it, but we should call the evening an argument with Kirk Varnadoe. Because up to the end, you described to me an evening conversation with you, on the phone you had with him the night before he died, you were arguing about something.
Yes, in fact, we were arguing about Elvis Presley because we had been driving around that
How
day.
How could I forget?
Yeah. We had been driving around that day listening to old Elvis records, partly in his, we were up on holiday, not knowing that he was as ill as he turned out to be. And we were listening to Elvis records, and our son, Luke, who was his godson, his favorite Elvis record is Devil in Disguise, which is sort of a terrible Elvis record from the mid-60s and very low Elvis. And he said, well, what's he like best on the Elvis record? And he said, Devil in Disguise. He said, ooh, that's very bad. That's very bad Elvis. You haven't been playing the Sun Sessions for him. And I said, well, we've been trying, but, you know, that's a little more difficult, you know. For, he said, well, you got to play. I really, you know, you have a responsibility to play him good Elvis if you're going to be playing Elvis. I said, I'm trying, but, you know, he likes Devil in Disguise and a little more conversation, a little less conversation. He likes those things. He likes them, but your job is to teach him what's good and what's bad. And that was the last conversation we had. He died 4 or 5 hours later. So that, and he believed passionately, as do I, that argument makes art, that argument is at the core of what we mean by it. When we talk about aesthetics, we don't mean something intrinsically lovely that we admire. We mean something that captures the nature of human difference, human conflict. We mean something exactly where you have two writers, whether it's E.B. White and Adam Gopnik, or two more significant ones, who are in friction, who are using each other and arguing with each other about
rubbing.
Rubbing.
A form of friction.
That's
nearly
right.
They're giving eczema to each other. Right. I was actually thinking about that because when I brought those two texts together, yours and E.B. White's, to particularly illustrate the essay form, the great essay form, was, you know, our granddaddy, who in this case happens to be French, Montaigne, who wrote Les Essais, the essays, and whose essays are but a rewriting of Plutarch, and then Montaigne was rewritten by Pascal, and you rewrite E.B. White. And so, you know, it isn't the same thing as the Oprah show at all, or the Oprah book she was featuring, which I hear is selling very well, because in some way this is a form of dialogue you're having with someone, and the essay form is one of the best ways in which you can actually have that dialogue.
Yes, dialogue with the dead, though fortunately dead. The dialogue with the dead and the out of copyright. That's the rule.
Right. You have to choose them carefully.
Yes, so that's why Montaigne dialogue with Plutarch. You know,
yeah, exactly. He was long safe. I also am curious. You seem to think. Well, maybe I shouldn't phrase the question this way. What has changed since 9/11 in New York? And the comment about the comment made that irony is dead after 9/11. Or that.
Boy, that turned out to be only I have said things as unprescient as that. I wrote an essay for the New Yorker back in about 1992 called "Death of an Audience," about how the audience for museums was disappearing. I did a version of it too. That turned out to be the single worst prediction that anyone's ever made, as you can discover by visiting the Museum of Modern Art. Now, one of the things that's the hard thing to get, I think. Though we all experience, it's not hard to get, it's hard to say, because it touches on certain taboos, I think, is that on the one hand, your experience of 9/11 was that this was anyone with any historical consciousness would know that it altered everything, you know, a sudden raid and the loss of that much life and of two great buildings in a capital city, anyone with an historical consciousness would know that it would change everything, as the cliche has it. But anyone with a sense of reality knows that it hasn't, knows that the rhythms and rituals and rites of the city in themselves went on from that and on largely unchanged. The internal landscapes of our minds had changed profoundly. And so we were stuck between those two kinds of knowledge, in fact. And, you know, we've lived our lives the last 5 years more or less waiting for the other shoe to drop, as everyone says. And what we've discovered is that you can live quite well on one leg, in fact, that the real nature of existence is to hop through existence. We don't get to stride through it or run through it. We hop through our lives with the knowledge that the other shoe may drop, will drop. It could have dropped this afternoon, may drop. But you don't have a choice. You can't simply stand there on one leg forever. You hop forward.
And you wonderfully describe New York, quoting somebody, you're walking through Park Avenue, looking at some of the wonderful structures there, and I can't remember the person you're walking with, but friend of yours who says that the reason New York continues to be a vibrant city is because men today have children late. The notion of delayed marriage, I think, is a notion.
Everyone in New York
instead of being 25, they are now 35. And as long as people continue to have children late, this city will continue to thrive.
Everyone in New York has one billionaire friend, one celebrity friend. You know, you always know one person, only one, right. But you do know. I know one billionaire. And I have a friend who is, and he was a property tycoon, and he was walking me through Midtown the week after 9/11. And he was saying, and he was explaining to me why you could never build a building like the City Court Center or the Seagram's building and so on. So I said, so you really don't have any faith in New York. You don't really believe in New York. He said, oh no, he said, you know, it's just the opposite. You know, Keynes said, in the long run, we're all dead. In New York, in the short run, we're all dead, but in the long run, we're all fine. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, here's the thing about New York. Here's the key demographic that nobody sufficiently appreciates about New York. And this comes back to the theme of the book, it's the median age of childbearing. When people have children at 35, women and couples have children at 35, it changes everything. Because it means that through their 20s, instead of having children and starting a family, they're searching for a mate. And when people are searching for a mate, there is nothing you can do that can get them out of a city. Terrorism, anthrax, anything. If you were trying to get laid every Friday night, you are not going to New Jersey. Or there's simply no way you can be moved. And
to go to New Jersey.
Connecticut, where I'm always being moved by my wife. And you won't go. You just won't go. And if the company is moving, you don't look around and say, well, I guess it's time we go. You just say, I'll find another job. I'm not going. And that means then that when you do have children, by the time you're 35, instead of having them at 25, you're settled here. This is your home. This is what you're familiar with. This feels like home. It doesn't feel like the springboard to your real life. In fact, it just feels like home. And so you stay. And as a consequence of all of those people having sex in their 20s and children in their 30s, he felt that the future of the city was secure. And I love that notion, in fact, because that of all the things that people were saying after 9/11, the notion that it was not just sex in the city, but that sex around the city.
Yeah, you say sex is not only in the city from a real estate tycoon's point of view, it is the city.
It is
all
the city.
All the
city's hope relied on that notion, and it turned out to be true.
So in closing, the title of your book, Through the Children's Gate, explain it a little bit to the audience and talk also a little bit about your relationship to Christo's work.
The gates. The Children's Gate is, I'm sure most of you know, is an actual place. It's the entrance to Central Park at 76th Street on the east side of the park because when Olmsted were designing the park, they had, and I haven't been able to quite track down exactly whose idea it was originally, they had the slightly waggish but romantic idea of naming all the entrances to the park after imaginary groups who would enter the park. This was, after all, a park for the people. And so there's the Miner's Gate, the Engineer's Gate, the Scholar's Gate, my own old favorite, the Stranger's Gate up on the Upper West Side. And there's the Children's Gate. And the Children's Gate is where, presumably, children, one of more of the many classes and types who would enter Central Park and make it a park for the people, where they would come in. And I love that notion, that kind of 19th century notion, that there'd be one place where the children would troop in obediently. You can never actually see that it's called the Children's Gate because there's a hot dog vendor who parks his melancholy and his machine right in front of it all day long, all through good weather. So you have to get there early to see it. And as it happens, there's a playground right on the other side of it. So it's a real place. And we actually, on our first morning back in New York, we went through the Children's Gate, jet-lagged and bleary-eyed on our way to the playground. But it's also real city and symbolic city. It's part of the symbolic city for us too, because it...
You said that to be in New York, it's hard to be pure of heart, and that you like that your daughter can hear "fuck you, a-hole" and go, "Hey, we're home."
Yeah.
Didn't you ever want for them to have that kind of pure of heart time, that time where fairies and everything else exists, and that you can be pure, and the rest of the world, the tough part of the world, will come later?
I guess. And maybe it's an illusion. I think that New York, in a certain way, allows the purity of heart of kids, not the purity of their ears, perhaps, but the purity of their hearts, to thrive because they're making their lives in a resistant context. But they go on making their lives. I often think I saw once a little boy on the subway, getting on the subway, and he sat on the subway car. And immediately, he craned around to look out the window to see what would go by. Nothing, a wall. But that act of craning around, I thought was very moving. And I think that, if anything, the kind of daily dialogue between tiny, small consciousnesses and this vast impersonal city is more moving, creates another kind of purity of heart, in fact. And I think that it's one of the things, you know, when we read Henry James's account of his childhood in the city, or Salinger's great stories about children in the city, it's one of the things I think that moves us, is exactly the sense that the pure in heart surviving in an impure environment is more moving than the pure in heart managing in an already purified environment.
They grow up quicker, but they have imaginary friends.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Yes, exactly.
Do your French friends come to New York and visit? And if so, what do they think of New York?
Many French friends come and visit all the time. And French people, at least the Parisians I know, tend to love New York. They idealize New York. Say it's the most tonic city in the world, is what they always say. They tend to have, just as we have, a slightly skewed movie-driven version of Paris. They have a slightly skewed movie-driven version of New York. They tend, I often find, I don't know if you find this, Paul, to prefer uptown New York, where the buildings are tall and the avenues are long, to the downtown New York that many of us prefer. They have no interest in Greenwich Village that they've seen, right? They, or the Soho or something. So I think that they respond in that way too. I think that, and then of course they still come for things that sadly, any longer exist, like classic jazz and so on. You know, and they if you go to the Village Vanguard on a Sunday night, it's filled with French people waiting to hear Miles Davis. In fact, just as if you go to the flea market in Paris, it's filled with Americans waiting to find Django Reinhardt. So they have that. They, you know, it's the same kind of dialogue of the deaf in part, but I think that the French Parisian love of New York is one of the extraordinary things and moving things. They tend to, the writers that they like best about New York tend to be writers who we esteem but perhaps don't esteem sufficiently. Like Jerome Charon, for instance, you know, his Alphabetville novels are incredibly influential in Paris and keenly admired. Lady here.
1 second.
I just finished reading a book about Irène Nemirovsky. And the book, Suite Française, but this is now a book by Jonathan Weiss in analyzing her life, and raises the issue about assimilation, that Irène Nemirovsky never really was allowed to fit in. So I ask a hypothetical question. If you had remained in France, decided to stay there, do you think as a writer, or even just as a person living in France, that you would have had to assimilate, would have been allowed to assimilate, or always on the outside?
This is so bizarre that it's going to sound as though you're a plant in the audience, but I just finished reading that biography of Irène Nemirovsky. a day ago, 2 days ago, I guess. This just to fill in anybody who's understandably doesn't know what we're talking about. She was an extraordinary writer, came from Russia, Russian Jew originally, but of a kind of white Russian background, who wrote, became one of the most popular writers in France in the 1930s, and then wrote in private, it wasn't published until this decade, a novel about, Suite Française, about France in the occupation, not in the occupation, right, in 1940, in the year of the occupation, and then was taken off to Auschwitz and died there, in fact. But, and she's been made, understandably, into a kind of martyr. And what turns out to be true in the biography that we were just talking about is that she was a kind of anti-Semite. There's no other way of putting it. She had no Jewish identity or wanted no Jewish identity, and her husband wrote these heartbreaking letters after she was taken away to Alain Morand, the wife of the great writer and anti-Semitic writer Paul Morand, saying, but you must understand, because she had an in, Alain Morand did, with the occupation authorities, you must understand, she hates Jews. She always describes them badly. She's as anti-Semitic as you could possibly want someone to be. And this of a woman who was, by that time, probably already dead at Auschwitz. So it sets off many, many painful and resonant notion. I don't think I would ever have assimilated in France in that way, and that was one of the things that brought us back. But I don't think it was because I was Jewish. I think it was because I was an outsider. In other words, I don't think that was the crucial. That was the crucial variable.
A different way of putting it is, you were not French.
I was not French. No, I was not French Jewish or not French in any way. And as I've written, I think it's not even so much that you can be an outsider and become French. Look, Sarkozy, who's likely to become the next president of France, or as likely as anyone, is as much an outsider, and more of an outsider than anyone who's ever run for the presidency of the United States. You know, Dukakis was much less of an immigrant than Sarkozy. Sarkozy's father was an immigrant with a strong accent and a sense of himself as being an immigrant. He said to his son, "You'll never, you know, no, none of us could ever be elected, could ever succeed in French politics." So I don't think it has anything to do with being Jewish or being an outsider. Just as if you're in France at the age of 17 and at school when these very powerful cohorts are being formed, then you'll feel French no matter where you come from. If you're an outsider afterwards, then you'll be perpetually an outsider, it seems to me. So that's a very moving book, and it's strange you mentioned it because I've been brooding on it for the last few days. But I think that that's, and I also let me just add, since we're talking about it, I think that the tone of that book is a little unfair to Nemirovsky in the sense that God only knows what any of us would have done in that situation, right? And it's easy to look back and now say, how could she have said these things? How could they have written those letters? Her life was at stake. You know, what wouldn't you write or say at that moment? I don't know. I mean, but I just mean that it's awfully easy. You know, I thought about as I was reading it, she was one of those Russian, wealthy Russians who was raised in a second language. Her second language was French, just as Nabokov's second language, he was raised in English. And so Nabokov went off and was in France for a while, but went off to England. Had Nabokov's second language been French, would that been the language that he chose to write in, would have been a very different life for Nabokov too, in that way. So it's a fascinating story in it, but provocative.
I was just wondering about your reaction to the arrest of New York City. What do you think of, is it the Bronx, Queens, or Staten Island part of New York City in your estimation?
You know, it's funny. I just did a documentary for the BBC all about New York, and I got to travel a great deal in throughout New York, and of course it was an education for me. You know, I'm one of those terrible Manhattanites who think of Manhattan as the world.